It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. foreign and national security policy priorities for 2015 as U.S. President Barack Obama enters his fourth and final quarter. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel, coming to you as we do every year at this time from the campus of Georgetown University right here in Washington, D.C. Despite his status as a so-called lame duck, an elected official who is approaching the end of his tenure, President Obama ended 2014 in a dramatic fashion. He reached an agreement with China, setting ambitious targets to reduce greenhouse gases, and he upended more than 50 years of U.S. policy by opening diplomatic relations with Cuba. On the domestic front, he used executive action to legalize the situations of up to 5 million undocumented immigrants, and in doing so created a political problem for Republicans. Nonetheless, the Republican-controlled Congress can still stymie some of President Obama's foreign policy initiatives. Many Republicans are adamantly opposed to normalizing relations with Cuba, as are some Democrats, for that matter. Others will try to thwart his efforts to reach a nuclear deal with Iran. For more on the foreign policy challenges in the waning days of President Obama's second term, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Anthony Clark Arend is Professor of Government and Foreign Service and Director of the Master of Science in Foreign Service here at Georgetown University, and Ambassador Mark Lagon. He just finished serving a four-year term as Global Politics and Security Chair at the Master of Science in Foreign Service program at Georgetown University. Ambassador Lagon is now President of Freedom House. That's the longest-standing human rights organization in the United States. And both Tony Arend and Mark Lagon have recently published a book they co-edited and co-wrote entitled Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions. And both gentlemen join me here on the campus of Georgetown University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Nice to be with you, and thanks again for hosting us here. Tony Arend, let me begin with you, and I'm going to begin by reading a comment that I received from one of our faithful listeners from Nairobi, Kenya. He says the following, and I'm quoting from Ray Ondoro. He says, "The political pundits who wrote off President Obama during and after the midterm elections are agreed things are looking up for the president. The market is bullish, more jobs for Americans. Medicare and Medicaid are doing fine. Immigration reform is in the works. Improved relationships with Cuba. Russia is reeling from Obama's sanctions, etc. And they have now moved away from that pejorative term lame duck president to one walking with a spring in his step, assertive, confident, etc. What do you think about that?
I would not present the current situation that way. I do think the moves toward Cuba are very, very good and indicate a lot of possibilities for the future. I think the situation with China remains unclear. I don't really think the climate change agreement means anything yet. While the sanctions do seem to be affecting Russia, Putin is not down and out. And frankly, these to some degree are lucky occurrences. I still don't think that the United States has a foreign policy. I think our foreign policy administration is still in shambles, and I actually think the president needs to make a number of bold strikes in order to improve the foreign policy of the United States. So while I like to be an optimist, I like to look hopefully at things, I don't think that accurately reflects the situation in the administration.
Mark Lagon, what's your take on our listener's comment? Playing on this concept of lame duck, the fact that President Obama is on his way out, and presidents in this particular portion of their term generally can't accomplish too much except perhaps in the realm of foreign policy. What are your thoughts?
I think it's a good observation from your listener not to count out a president in the end of their term. There's still a great deal of initiative that can be shown. And President Obama is trying to show it with the opening to Cuba, although I think, as we say in the United States, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. If there is an effect for the lives of Cubans on their political freedom and choice improving, if there's a change in the nature of the way governance is being applied there, then that will be a successful policy, and that remains to be seen. The president is constrained. Yes, sanctions are pinching Russia because of its overreaching in Ukraine and the Crimea, but the initiative has been with Putin on that score, and the United States has been playing catch-up. The Western alliance is concerned about unity. I certainly hear from diplomats of other countries in Eastern Europe, they're concerned about that. And the president's focus on fighting ISIS is a necessity, but inaction on policy in the past in Syria may have contributed to that. It is a shame that the United States probably has to set aside some of the issues of human rights and other priorities to focus so much on ISIS.
A very good observation. Well, back to you, Tony Aaron, to talk about perhaps some of the constraints on President Obama. In these last 2 years of his term, we have a new Congress. Now the Republicans are in control of both chambers, both the House of Representatives and now the Senate, which they won in midterm elections in November. What does this GOP control of the Congress mean for President Obama in his last 2 years? What impact will that have on the formulation of foreign policy?
Well, it's interesting. Even with a split Congress before, the administration wasn't really, in my view, able to formulate a coherent foreign policy. So I'm not sure that the shift in Congress will have a dramatic effect on that. I mean, one specific point, it may be more difficult to get treaties through the Senate, but it's already been difficult to get treaties through the Senate. Otherwise, I don't think the change in government is going to have a profound impact on foreign policy per se, in large part because the president needs to initiate foreign policy. I don't see Congress as initiating foreign policy. And so I think what the president really needs to do is bring adult leadership into the White House. This is something which the Reagan administration did as it was suffering in its second term. It brought in Howard Baker, a remarkable gentleman, as White House chief of staff, and he was able to reorganize things, bring integrity and gravitas to the White House, and move things forward. I think the administration needs to do something like that now, and unless it does that, I don't think the nature of the Senate or the House will have any significant impact on foreign policy.
Mark Lagon, there are no shortage of critics of President Obama. His own cabinet members have written books, or former cabinet members, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and many others have criticized the White House. You just mentioned the Obama administration's policy vis-a-vis Syria. Many people have criticized on both sides of the aisle. But nonetheless, even as Tony Aaron said, it is the president who initiates foreign policy. The Congress does have a role, particularly with this opening to Cuba. Some members will look to constrain him. Some Republican members have said they are going to block the nomination of an ambassador. Talk about the constraints he may face with the new Congress.
Well, there's reason to be concerned that Congress will be obstructionist. The House Republicans have treated the president in the earlier part of his term as pure anathema, as the enemy. And the other House of Congress flipping to Republican control would be reason for concern. But it's a complicated situation. For instance, now the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is Bob Corker, who is moderate. He's interested in good government. He is no flaming ideologue. On the other side, now moving into the minority, the leading Democrat on the committee, Robert Menendez, has been a chief skeptic about the president's policy of negotiating with Iran on a nuclear accord, wanting to maintain the sanctions in place, and is very invested in a tough policy against Cuba and the sanctions. I agree with my friend, Tony, that there won't be major changes, but there will be some things, including nominees and treaties, that might be even harder to get through.
Now, it's also possible, as Mark suggests, that the Republican dominance in all of Congress could actually be useful for foreign policy. Because if the Republican leadership says, okay, we cannot just play the opposition role, we now have to play more of a leadership role, they could be more willing to compromise with the White House and put together some joint proposals. Now, needless to say, it's contingent upon the president wanting to play as well. And previously, it seemed as though neither branch of government wanted to play. So it's actually possible that we could see more collaboration and at least more agreement in certain areas. Again, I'm not holding my breath, but that would be possible.
We have a test of whether the U.S. political system has become permanently dysfunctional. Under President Clinton, he faced a bombastic ideological Speaker of the House in Newt Gingrich. House Republicans pushed for his impeachment over a small legal matter, and yet they got a lot of things done in balancing the budget, pursuing welfare reform, supporting with Senate concurrence NATO enlargement. Let's hope that that kind of cooperation between a Republican Congress and a Democratic president could occur again.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Anthony Clark Arendt. He's professor of government and foreign service, and Ambassador Mark Lagon, formerly global politics and security chair at the Master of Science in Foreign Service program, also at Georgetown University. He's now president of Freedom House. And both gentlemen join us from the campus of Georgetown University. We're discussing U.S. foreign policy challenges and priorities in 2015. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Please send your feedback also to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to Fakir Khan, a new listener from Kenya. Well, back to you, Tony Arendt, and let's get into some specific areas of foreign policy that you think President Obama is likely to make headway in the coming year. We can start perhaps with Iran. That's an extremely important issue. The talks were extended to try to curb Iran's nuclear program. How do you think that particular issue is going to play out?
Well, it's very difficult to say. Some would say that the extension of the talks till March of 2015 was simply kicking the can down the road and was an unwillingness on the part of people now to say it's just not going to be successful. I don't know. Strangely as this may sound, the opening to Cuba might actually be a positive indication to Iran that the United States can, in fact, deal with states which were formerly classified as persona non grata. I don't want to overstate that case, but that may be an indication. But honestly, it's very difficult to read how things are going to be turning out there. Needless to say, Israel has been strongly opposed to any kinds of negotiations with Iran, and they continue to fear the potential of an Iranian nuclear weapon, and that could have an impact on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. negotiations. So I think it's difficult to say. Personally, I think it was better that the talks were extended to March as opposed to declaring that they were unsuccessful this year, but I think time will ultimately tell us whether they're going to be successful or not.
Mark Lagon.
It wouldn't surprise you, having become president of Freedom House, that in talking about Iran, I also look at the way Iran is governed and the way Baha'is and women and others are treated. The degree to which Rouhani as a leader can be trusted to compromise must not ignore the human rights situation. When he took power, in the very weeks after he came to power, the application of the death penalty became even more rampant in Iran. So we should look at that. And as a matter of the world, understanding the way the United States operates, it's difficult for the United States, in its style of foreign policy, to entirely ignore questions of governance and human rights as it tries to make deals with dictators.
Absolutely. Well, we'll just have to see. On Iran, there are formidable challenges because of objections from leading Democrats as well as Republicans on negotiating with Iran. But it's clear that President Obama would obviously like to have this under his belt, Tony Arendt. To be able to reach an agreement would be something that he would like as part of his legacy, I assume.
Certainly. Although I do say that with Iran, one needs to regard an agreement, even if it is concluded, with a grain of salt, because that would be an agreement with the current regime for now. And it's not as though we could hold that up and say it was an absolute achievement, because things are very fluid and one never knows where things are going to go. Certainly the Obama administration would like to be able to chalk that off as a victory. But even if it is a victory, it lacks the permanence that I think the administration would like to see in a legacy.
You mentioned, of course, Cuba, and that's a huge issue now. Where do you think that particular issue is going, given that there's also an enormous amount of opposition from both Republicans and Democrats? And at the same time, there are some so-called moderate Republicans, such as Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona, who are very much in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba.
Well, with all due respect for those individuals who think that the movement of the administration is a mistake, I think there's an inevitability to it. My own sense is that the whole sanctions regime that was established in the Kennedy administration made sense at the time, But I think the U.S. stance toward Cuba has not made sense for at least the past 20 or 30 years. Among Cuban dissidents, Yoani Sanchez, for example, is a noted Cuban dissident and blogger. She's here with us at Georgetown this year as our Yahoo Fellow, has been modestly supporting these changes, these developments, these movements toward better relations between the United States and Cuba. I think there are still going to be forces that oppose them, but I think this is an inevitability, and I think many would say that, even people that might overtly oppose it. So there may be some bumps in the road, there may be some backward steps, but I think ultimately we will be moving toward full diplomatic relations with Cuba, just a matter of time. I think the demographics, the changes in the administration, and of course the ages of Raul and Fidel Castro point in that direction.
Mark Lego, were you surprised when President Obama made this announcement last year to begin to normalize relations with Cuba? And do you also see a sort of inevitability about it?
Well, there were murmurs in Washington that it was under discussion. I have to say I was a bit surprised that it was taken up quickly. The question is, how does the United States use it? One thing that the United States imagines is that the citizens of Cuba might have access to information on social media. But that remains in the hands of the Cuban government. And lots of dictatorships around the world have found canny ways to turn social media against civil society and, in fact, monitor civil society. So we have to see whether the United States can take advantage of increased diplomatic relations and the degree to which Congress allows commerce to increase, whether there will be, in fact, a political change. It's incumbent on the United States to try.
And this is actually one thing that Yoani Sanchez emphasized. She said, this is a good opening move, but now we have to pressure the Cuban government. There are about 100 political prisoners that are imprisoned in Cuba, to release them, to allow more open access to the internet, to allow more freedom of speech. Now that the United States is in a position to have some leverage, it makes sense to make these kinds of moves early and right now.
It's not surprising that there are some elements of the Cuban emigre community in the United States who are not in favor of the lifting of the embargo or even the creation of diplomatic relations. But there is pluralism in Cuba in the sense that people disagree about this. The very important civil society protest group, the Women in White, have come out against the lifting of the embargo and feel that this is handing a Christmas gift, as it were, to the Castro brothers. So there are differences about what this policy
ought to be. And, of course, lifting the embargo, that entails – that's more complicated because the Congress has to agree to that.
Potentially, yes. But it depends on exactly how the president does it and what kind of exceptions are made. And there is also a role for presidential authority to be acting as the person responsible for maintaining foreign policy. So there may be some potentials for the president to act independently. I would also note one important role in this that we haven't mentioned is the Pope.
Okay.
Is that Pope Francis played a significant role as an interlocutor. And I know when we met last year, this was something we had talked about, is the potential for the Pope to play a very positive role in international affairs. And this one instance is simply one instance, but I would note that the Pope's language, the Pope's speeches, addresses on a whole host of foreign policy issues, I think, have been a very positive influence in international affairs.
Well, I think that's a good point. And what about this, Mark Lego? The opening to Cuba will have most likely a very positive effect on U.S. relations with Latin America in general, because many of these countries in Latin America, you know, have been puzzled as to the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Cuba, and that has been an impediment to better relations. To what extent do you think this opening to Cuba will have a positive impact on our relations with
A talking point on the part of Latin American governments, particularly those that are sort of described as populist, particularly focused on a dominant role of the United States in the world and criticizing it, governments which have suspended term limits on their leaders and their constitutions, they no longer have the talking point that the United States is living in the past with respect to the sanctions. But there are plenty of remaining areas of difference with the United States, including just the way a series of governments like Venezuela and Ecuador and others are moving away from pluralism and away from free expression.
That's going to be a challenge always for many years to come. But let's move on now to other challenges, Tony Arendt. I mean, there's so many, particularly as we go into 2015. What else do you see President Obama grappling with? We talked about, you know, the fight against ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, and the fact that perhaps had the United States dealt more forcefully vis-a-vis the conflict in Syria, initially we would not be where we are, but that's water under the bridge. What about that particular issue?
So I think this is a serious problem, and I will go back to what Mark said. I do think that the United States intervened much too late in that whole process. And this is where I go back to what for me is a fairly consistent theme, and that is the lack of a foreign policy, the lack of a coherent foreign policy that is articulately expressed. When we look at the Syria conflict, we saw the president draw a red line, and the red line was overstepped, and then the president seemed to draw back from that. And then the president saying, our goal is to absolutely eliminate ISIS, which I think is a silly goal because we can't actually achieve the absolute elimination of ISIS. I don't think we have a coherent foreign policy in the region. And I feel as though there's a bubble around the president, and the kinds of advice he is getting is not conducive to him developing any kind of coherent foreign policy. And so it seems to be fits and starts, mm-hmm. and we're going to try this, and then we're going to try this. Situation in Afghanistan hasn't gotten any better. The Taliban has taken over some places that were previously held by the United States. ISIS continues to move about in Iraq. So my recommendation to the administration would actually be to take a step back, to think coherently about what our goals are in the region, what it is we can reasonably accomplish, what kinds of resources we can reasonably devote to the situation, and make some decisions there. The best we might be able to do is contain ISIS. The best we might be able to do is recognize that Iraq will fall apart, that there may be a Sunni part of Iraq, there may be a Shia part of Iraq, and there will be a Kurdish state or something like that. And I feel as though we're trying to redraw all the boundaries that existed and put the genie back in the bottle, and that may not be possible. But I think because there's a lack of coherence that we're coming up with those kinds of non-solutions.
Mark Lagan, the lack of coherency in your view with respect to foreign policy, notwithstanding a couple of these dramatic...
I agree with my friend Tony about the lack of coherence. I worry about the policy becoming too singularly focused on ISIS mm-hmm. now. Tony has written a very thought-provoking essay in our book, Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions, about terrorism and counterterrorism. There are three points worth making here. One, as recently the Senate Intelligence Committee put out a report about brutal treatment of detainees by the United States. The United States needs to be an example, and it creates more terrorists than it eliminates by overzealous, cruel, and inhuman counterterrorism policy. Secondly, the sheer brutality, the love of pain being inflicted that one sees with ISIS reminds us that terrorism is a threat to human dignity. It's a threat to human rights. It's not just the responsibility of those who are fighting terrorism to respect human rights, but it's at heart a problem there. Final point, it's a mistake for the United States to tell autocratic governments in the Middle East that they have carte blanche to fight terrorists and not reform. Those terrorists are only egged on by autocracies that are rigid, that are fragile. We need to press states to change. When we tell Bahrain that we don't mind, that it cracks down on civil society and gets Saudi help to do that, we're doing the worst thing for U.S. interest, both on fighting terrorism and promoting stability and human rights.
Back to you, Tony Arendt. I mean, you put your finger on the problem, as did Mark, and you know, in the couple of years left in President Obama's term, do you really see any changes, the likes of which you're recommending, advisors with more gravitas, a greater coherency in policy?
Honestly, no, because I haven't seen the administration make these changes thus far. I don't think the president is really willing to bring in new blood. And by new blood, I very specifically mean a new White House chief of staff, a new national security advisor, likely a new secretary of state. We're hopefully going to have a new secretary of defense. So I don't see the president willing to do that. And I see much more muddling along. Now, we may get some surprises, like the Cuban overture was indeed a surprise. So there may be some things going on in the periphery, but I don't see any potential for the kind of change that I think we're needed. Now, there's one exception. This could actually be where Congress, now that there is a majority of Republicans in both houses of Congress, that Congress impresses upon the president the need to put together this foreign policy, and there's sort of a coherent push to the president to make some kind of change. That may not happen either, but if you ask me to bet, I would say I bet things are going to just pretty much go along the way they have been for the past several years, for the last 2 years.
You know, I think that a foreign policy often flows from the very top. George Bush's foreign policy, George W. Bush's foreign policy flowed from his temperament. He looked at the world in Manichaean terms of the good and the bad, and he was inclined to use the military instrument. And he gave a bad name to democracy promotion policy by pursuing it at the end of a bayonet in Iraq. With President Obama, the problem lies with his temperament. He is a very smart and very articulate president, but he is perhaps overly deliberative. Sometimes you just have to make a decision. And in terms of Syria, that's an example. And I think, in fact, he invited more Russian adventurism in Ukraine with dithering on Syria, including basically turning to Russia to be the arbiter to deal with chemical weapons there.
I've heard that said before. Of course, now we're bringing up Russia. At the same time, we're seeing Russia reeling from the falling ruble, oil prices diminishing, main source of revenue for Russians, as well as our sanctions. That is, the U.S. and EU sanctions seem to be squeezing President Putin. To what extent this will help change his policy vis-a-vis Ukraine? Will that persuade him to stop backing the separatists in the East?
I think it's correct that the sanctions seem to have had their intended effect on Russia. I don't really see that changing Putin. Again, it almost goes back to temperament. And it's going to be to continue to make inroads, whether it's in Ukraine or elsewhere. My sense is that the United States needs to hold the line. And I would say in particular, there's a lot of concern in the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. There's concern in Poland. These are all members of NATO, and I think the U.S. needs to send very, very clear messages to those states that we will not tolerate any Russian adventurism in those states, that the NATO treaty means something. And I think that's perhaps one of the best signals we can send to Putin.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank you both, Professor Anthony Arendt and Ambassador Mark Lagon, for joining us.
Carol, great to be with you.
Thank you very much, Carol.
And best of luck to you, Mark, in taking the helm at Freedom House.
Thanks a lot.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.